The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Jordan Harper. He joins us on the telephone in Southern California. He's got a new novel coming out. It's called A Violent Masterpiece. Welcome to the program, Jordan.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be back.
Wow, Jordan, you've really done it this time. How'd you get the idea for this one?
Well, you know, while this is not strictly a sequel to my last novel, everybody knows, it is set in the same world, and I'd kind of planted some of the clues for the what was to come in that book. So I'd known I was going to write another big, epic L.A. crime novel involving the rich and the powerful and the police department and corruption, and I knew what some of the darker turns were going to be. We can leave buried for now. But so I just kind of knew that I had really kind of achieved something I was really proud of with Everybody Knows, and I knew there was a deeper level to it. So I really just kind of tried to keep that energy going and, in fact, turn it all the way up. And if there's a real difference between these two novels, I would say that maybe that book is written at a 9 and this one is at as loud as the speakers will go.
Uh-huh. And it opens that way. We've got this guy named Jake, and he's in his car, he's driving around L.A., and he's some kind of a program host or something. Tell us about this guy. What's he doing?
Well, he is something between a nightcrawler, which you remember that movie, Nightcrawler. That's somebody who drives around looking for crimes to film, looking for exciting incidents to film. But, you know, that model of doing things is kind of on the downside because everybody has phones now. Everybody has cameras with them, and so the guy rushing around getting footage and then selling it for the morning news, that doesn't really kind of pay as well as it used to. And so what Jake has done is started just live streaming it. So he's really out there like transmitting live to an audience that is like wants to see the craziest, wildest side of LA. So he's, you know, listening to a police scanner. He's narrating everything he does. And he's just trying to paint this picture of Los Angeles that people kind of want to believe in as this absolutely like blood, smoke, blood and gun smoke world. And so that's what he gives them. And you know, Los Angeles is a very big place. If that's what you're looking for, you can find it.
Mm-hmm. And so he's got these audience people out there and they're rewarding him. It's a lucrative thing for him if he's finding the right things to watch, to observe. They're giving him tips. They're loading up on his stream and we're watching it all in real time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, yes, he has subscribers. He has multiple tiers. So if you want to see the really bloody and brutal stuff, you have to, you know, subscribe to the inner circle, you know, which is not unlike some people who are really out there on Instagram and other services where you can find people. They might not be quite as verbose as Jake is, but they're out there.
You tell this story from three principal viewpoints. Tell us about Kara.
So Kara is what's known as a private concierge, which is a service that exists in Los Angeles and any place where there's people with a lot of money. And what they do is they make acquiring things easy. Now, there's a completely legitimate form of private concierge who will help you find, you know, the most exclusive hotels and the most, you know, coveted concert tickets. But Kara works for a slightly different service. And she gets you the things that other people would be afraid to go get. So she can get you drugs, of course. She can introduce you to pill-pushing doctors. She can introduce you to willing sex partners. She can kind of fulfill the fantasies that, you know, the rich and powerful, as we're learning, absolutely have. Now, she does have a line, and she has a compromised moral center, but what she begins to suspect is that there are other people in her business who don't have those lines.
Mm. And she has a colleague who is a big part of the story, but she's missing.
Yeah. Kara was brought into this trade by a woman named Phoebe, who becomes her best friend. And then a few months before the novel begins, Phoebe has gone missing, and Kara saw something the night that Phoebe went missing that has led her to believe that perhaps the rich and powerful people around them had something to do with Phoebe's disappearance. But she is so frightened and so unsure of what that is that she doesn't know what to do until the novel begins, and she discovers another clue that leads her to suspect that there's very foul play at work indeed.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Jordan Harper. His new crime novel, A Violent Masterpiece. And as we move along through here, at least I have this image of a remote ranch in New Mexico and possibly some hidden secrets. This has a very Epstein Files kind of vibe to it. Were you influenced at all by this Epstein thing?
Oh, you know, absolutely. I mean, I think that's undeniable. And I began planting the seeds of that again, and Everybody Knows. And to be honest, I was a little worried that by the time this novel came out, Epstein was going to feel like old news, or people would kind of put it aside. But instead, it turns out the Epstein Files ain't going away, as people say. And so, yes, I drew very heavily from the Epstein Files. I drew very heavily from the conspiracy theories around him and his death. And, without too many spoilers, if this means something to some of your listeners, the second section of the novel is called Hyoid, which is a bone in the throat that doesn't tend to break if you hang yourself, but it does tend to break if somebody strangles you. And I leave, that people can Google that at will and try and figure out what that has to do with anything. But yes, I was very much inspired by the Epstein Files.
Yeah. And the title. I like where you got the title. Readers who discover this will go, uh-huh, yep.
You mean the in-book reason for the title?
Right. The guy says it in a speech.
The title is a line of dialogue in the book. It comes out of the mouth of a man who trains police departments how to kill people, which is sadly a job that exists in the real world. But also it came from a great 70s cover that I saw for Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest. It was this beautiful little trade paperback with a bright red cover and a man standing over a woman's body. And then it just said in giant letters, Dashiell Hammett's Violent Masterpiece, Red Harvest. And I saw that book cover and I thought, that's great. I wish my books had the phrase A Violent Masterpiece on it. And then I realized, you can name a book anything you want. And so that's where the title came from. And then I found a way to work it into the book.
I love that backstory. all right, we've got a third point of view here. And I have to confess, his point of view is my favorite. And this is an attorney named Gibson. Tell us about him.
So Gibson is what you might call a street lawyer. He started out as a public defender. He has a backstory that led him to be very suspicious of police officers because his stepfather was a violent cop. And he has kind of made it his life to kind of battle the system. He knows that the justice system is slanted against defendants. The way he puts it is the defense attorney is the knife that you bring to the gunfight. And he is determined to, provide protection to people who don't always get it. But as the novel starts, he has sort of a moral quandary because he's used to working for poor people, for people who don't have any resources. And he is approached by a very powerful Hollywood producer who has been arrested on suspicion of sex crimes. And while he doesn't normally want to defend the rich and the powerful, he senses that there's something going on here that might cause the system more problems. And he's enticed by the battle that is kind of hinted at. So he decides to help this guy out, and it drags him into a world of depravity and violence that he just had no idea was out there.
Oh, I'll say. The book is a violent masterpiece by Jordan Harper, who joins us on the phone in Southern California, where this novel is set. And these characters, these three main points of view, they're destined to kind of get together. I don't think it's a spoiler to say, because we have rumors that there's a serial killer on the loose. The police don't agree with this, but Jake is out there on the street, and he's starting to think so, and so is Kara. She's starting to think so.
Yeah, the killer's name is the L.A. Ripper. I wanted to feel like sort of a throwback to, like, the, if you'll forgive me, golden age of serial killers when they had names and the streets really felt haunted. To be honest, and this, the people in the book say this, serial killers are not as common as they used to be. They're still very common in our media because they hold some dark appeal to us. But I kind of wanted to capture that icky feeling that I get when I watch true crime, and I do watch it. You know, I definitely critique it in the book, and I talk about how it's very weird to get excited about crimes, but we do, and I wanted to kind of look at that head on, and I wanted to admit that if there was an L.A. Ripper in Los Angeles killing people, that people would kind of get excited in a weird way. And so that is what Jake sort of weaponizes in his quest for eyeballs, is that he is out there doing death tours of where all the victims, or alleged victims, as you say, are found. Because, as you say, the police are, in the novel, denying that there's a serial killer. They're saying these are just random killings. But I don't think it's a spoiler to reveal that, no, in fact, the L.A. Ripper is out there.
Well, L.A. is such a great place to set these kinds of stories. There's just something about Los Angeles. Now, I know you're a Midwesterner, and you've really embraced that terrain out there. Tell us what it is about it that you find so beautiful to write about.
Well, you know, I mentioned that Jake, the live streamer, is very verbose, and he turned out to be one of my favorite characters I've ever written because he allowed me to monologue on things that I oftentimes actually believe. And one of the things he says in that first chapter is that Los Angeles is America in a lot of ways, and people want to think it's someplace out there on the coast and it's different. But, you know, Los Angeles is made out of dreams and violence and land grabs and cars. It is the most American place. It is also America dreaming itself. You know, this is where America produces, like, the dreams of its own subconscious that we see in Hollywood movies and things like that. And so there is something so exciting and alive about this place, and also scary. And I just find it this beautiful place. It's also a place that couldn't exist without immigrants, which is, again, very American. This is a land of, you know, we have more Korean people than any city in the world outside of Korea. We have more Thai people than any city outside of Thailand. You know, we have that for Armenia as well. And, you know, a lot of other places. So there's something that is just so alive and American about this place. And, you know, that's for good and ill, both. But for now, this is absolutely my home. And the weather's not bad either.
Well, it's also a place that probably wouldn't exist without the Colorado River, but that's a totally different subject.
Yes, and we might be learning that.
Right.
Sooner rather than later. Yes. And that is also very true, and that Los Angeles is literally America with its back against the wall. You know, we're here. It's always been this push westward in America, again, for good and ill. And this is it. This is as west as it gets. This is America with its back against the wall and with no place left to run. And that, again, heightens this drama that I try and weave throughout this, you know, big crime novel.
Mm. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, community-owned public radio for curious listeners. I've been joined by Jordan Harper. We're talking about his new novel, A Violent Masterpiece. You're a big movie guy, aren't you?
I am. I used to be a movie critic in a previous life, and I still do, like, DVD commentaries, and I love to go to the movies. I have a movie theater in my neighborhood that's a five-minute walk, plays old movies, and it's my favorite place.
Do you have some favorite genres? Are you into, like, the noir, or what are you into?
Well, you know, I do like film noir, but I do tend to favor neo-noir, and I do worry sometimes that my genre of, like, the dark crime novel sometimes get cast so much with film noir that it begins to feel old, because at this point, a lot of these movies we're talking about are 80 years old, and that doesn't mean they're not good. They're great. But I do think there's a lot of exciting things that have happened in crime fiction since then. So I do love sort of every iteration of crime fiction, the neo-noir of the 70s, you know, the stuff that Nicholas Winding Refn's been doing. Michael Mann is obviously a huge influence on me. And then I like a lot of Japanese crime films. I'm a big fan of the director Kinji Fukasaku, who just made literally dozens of films about the Japanese Yakuza. I like, you know, Chinese crime films. I like surrealist films. I love David Lynch and you know, kind of that darker side of surrealism. And what I'm actually doing right now, I'm doing a tour of my local video store, because my local movie theater, Vidiots, also has a video store in it. And I'm watching one film from every director in the director section in alphabetical order, in order to kind of, you know, open my horizons a little bit. So yeah, I do love movies.
So when you say a tour, it's your own self-guided tour?
Yeah, every day, or not every day, but every time I go back, I just go to the next director on their director shelf. I'm currently 60 movies into this process, and I have gotten to the middle of the seas.
Whoa.
So this is going to be, Vidiots is an amazing video store. So this is going to be, I estimate, about a 7-year project, and it will involve several hundred movies. I don't even know how many yet.
So you might be talking about a 1,000-page nonfiction book after that.
I might be overeducated at that point in film.
That you are definitely into film. Your buddy S.A. Cosby always says such nice things about you, and he gave you such a great blurb on this new novel. What a generous man! I know you guys are buddies, and I'm wondering, you just talked about these directors. What crime novels are big influences on you, or what writers do you really have in your pantheon?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, Sean is a very good friend of mine. He's actually in town right now for the LA Book Festival, and we had dinner last night. So it was great to see him. And, you know, obviously he's the gold standard right now. I thought King of Ashes was tremendous, and I All the Sinners Bleed is still my favorite of his novels. So, you know, obviously I love his work. He's just, he's out there telling stories nobody else is telling, and he's got such a voice. I remain a huge fan of Megan Abbott's. Megan is probably the person who I get most excited about when a new book comes out, just because I know I'm going to swallow it in about 2 days.
Mm.
You know, unsurprisingly, you know, James Ellroy is a huge influence on me, and always has been, always will be. David Peace, who is a British crime author, currently lives in Japan and writes crime stories set in Japan. But his earlier novels about crime and punishment in Yorkshire, England, are some of my very favorite books. And I just, again, I'd like to do programs for myself to keep refilling my tank. I just did a reread of all of Cormac McCarthy's novels from Blood Meridian through the Road, in companion with a nonfiction book about his philosophy that kind of went chapter by chapter and took his books apart. So the last like 6 books I've read have been Cormac McCarthy novels and this nonfiction text. And I still think, you know, he's an American master. Absolutely.
Tell me, Jordan, are you betting on his car?
Oh, the Lotus. No, it is. You know, it's not a functional car.
Okay.
It's a project car. It is. I thought about it though.
Uh huh. Yeah, yeah. I saw you posted something on Twitter about it. I thought that was pretty funny.
Also, it's to be totally honest, it's a manual transmission Lotus, and I could, if like I was driving in a, or if I was riding in a car where somebody had a manual transmission and they had a heart attack, I think I could get them to the hospital, but that's about as well as I drive a manual transmission car. So I don't know if me buying Cormac McCarthy's Lotus would be a good thing or probably just a disaster for all parties. But it's out there. Somebody, I almost sent it to Sean. I don't know. Uh-huh. He could probably drive manual if he's looking to do something stupid with some money, you know?
Well, he's a car guy for sure.
Well, he is. That's what I mean.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about A Violent Masterpiece without giving away too much. There's this group of people, of men, who once again, they reminded me of Epstein's circle, and they are a big part of this story.
If you are rich and you have desires that you want fulfilled, you can get those desires fulfilled. And these guys, they're not like an organization with like an org chart or leaders. They're just a group of friends who kind of share some really gross interests. And they are dubbed over the course of the novel, the kids in the candy store, based on a line that somebody says, you know, when you're a kid in the candy store, you eat what you want. And that is sort of the perspective I think a lot of these people have. They live in a world without no in it, you know, and when you get that way, you find out who you are. And I think what we're learning is that maybe it's not a good thing for people to find that out. Maybe we need some more walls up. And you know, it's just, frankly, some people have too much money. You don't need that much. And, you know, if you're able to fulfill your every desire, that is a really good sign that you have more than you need.
And that desire to eat whatever you want could lead to cannibalism.
It could. I would encourage people to read A Violent Masterpiece to find out. but yes, that's the thing is there's no limit to what money can buy. And I think, again, we are learning that if there's something, if you want to take the least conspiratorial view of the Epstein files that you can, it is that a man abused dozens, if not hundreds, of girls twice before any real consequences were going to accrue to him. That, you know, he basically walked in Florida, even though he, quote unquote, was under house arrest. That's you can't refute that he was able to do that and then rejoin this society of rich people and hang out with all of these people. That's the fact. That's just a fact. Like, you can't argue with that. You have to look at the world through the lens of all of those things are true, whether or not you think he killed himself, whether or not you think that there was a, like, real organization. I tend to think most conspiracies happen in the real world in a much looser, more organic way than is sometimes portrayed in, like, conspiracy thrillers. You know, I don't think it's a lot of precisely lying dominoes. I think it's a lot of people kind of going along to get along most of the time, and not wanting to rock the boat and not wanting to press up against power that they fear can squash them. And by the way, that's a valid fear. This kind of power can squash people and does squash people. You know, you see it in Hollywood, you learn about people that Harvey Weinstein blackballed, not just in his own movies, but just kind of throughout Hollywood. And you go, what happened to that one actress? Why didn't she work much? And then you find out it was because he was bad-mouthing her for years. These kind of things really do happen. And it's really important that we acknowledge the kind of power and violence that is necessary to make the world we currently live in possible.
Well, after the Me Too movement swept some of the famous kind of media abusers away, it's kind of sickening that we have people in very high, powerful positions who have been implicated in this kind of behavior. And you wonder, will there ever be justice? Will anything ever come of this? In other countries, some people are being prosecuted, but it seems like if you're an American, you've got a free pass.
Well, it certainly does. And I think, you know, part of Gibson's point of view, the defense attorney in this novel, is that the justice system is not set up to prosecute the rich and powerful. That's not why they set it up in the first place. It just, again, it just isn't that. You know, the kind of prisons that we run, the kind of police forces that we put on the street are not, it's not a bunch of highly trained accountants who are going out and finding out bosses are stealing wages from employees. It's about catching shoplifters, even though wage theft is as big a crime as shoplifting is. And so, no, our system is not set up to deal with this. There's just a very basic thing of people want to think that the law is this objective object. And the truth is that the law has to, at all cases, be interpreted by human beings. And if all of those human beings, from the cops to the prosecutors to the judges, all agree on concepts of who is and who is not a criminal, then it does not matter what laws you have on the books, because there is always, you know, a way to choose not to press charges, to choose who you do pull over and who you don't. Uh-huh. All these things are baked into the just basic subjectiveness of being a human being. And if we try and deny that and act like, laws work just by being laws. I think we're all seeing right now that's just not true.
Mm-hmm. Jordan Harper has joined us. His book is a violent masterpiece. I love it when novels address some of these social justice issues. You have a scene in the book where some of these rich abusers have done something wrong, and the police are notified, hey, you need to come and check this out. And the second that the cops hear the names of the suspects, they immediately lose interest and walk away.
That is based on a true story. If you know about the recent history of Los Angeles and powerful people crimes, you will know what I'm talking about. But there are instances when the cops stumble onto something and then they learn who they're talking to and they choose, again, to walk away. That's what I'm saying, is that they always have these choices about what to do and what not to do. And as long as that's true, that is a flaw in the system that has to be addressed on multiple levels, I would say. But it is very true that sometimes cops will see something and they will just walk away because they don't want the hassle.
Sure. Well, Jordan, before I let you go, I'm curious, are you working on something? And is it anything that you want to talk about, even just a little bit?
Well, yeah, sure. I don't mind. I have started the new novel. It's going slowly. And I have, some movie work that I'm doing and other things. But my next novel, I'm going to take a break from Los Angeles. I'm going to take a break from big, epic conspiratorial crimes. I'm probably going back to the Ozarks. I'm writing a sort of Bonnie and Clyde love story, Love on the Run, and set in the 90s. It's called The Wildest Things. And I'm really excited to kind of shift gears for a little while. And I definitely will write another Los Angeles book. But I really wanted to take a break and do something very different and do something kind of a crime story, but a romantic crime story.
Wow. The Ozarks, back to your old home turf, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I know that it has to be rural and I'm still sketching it out, but I do think I want a place where when they're on the run, they're on the run in a gorgeous place. And the Ozark Hills are really pretty. And so, that's what I'm working on now. I don't know how long it'll take me. I'm slower than I wish I was. Sean tends to lap me in getting books out often. But that is what I'm working on right now.
And it sounds like the two of you review the other guy's work. You let him look stuff over. Is that how it works?
Yeah, we both look at each other's stuff beforehand. He shares more with me than I do with him, but that's how I am in general. I like to keep stuff really close to the chest until I really have it polished. So I'm with that. I'm like that with everyone. But we talk all the time, both about the stories we're working on and also publishing and what it's like to be an author. It is. We were both flown out to Spain a few months ago to go to a crime festival. And that was really special because, I'm from the Ozarks and he's from, rural Virginia. And to be a couple of guys got flown to Spain to talk about crime fiction, it felt pretty cool. And so I'm really glad to have a friend in this world, for sure.
Well, this is quite a book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a violent masterpiece. Jordan Harper wrote it, and he's joined us on the program today. And we really appreciate your time, Jordan.
Oh, thanks. No, I'm glad to be here anytime.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Vic McCunis.